Okay, I'd like to begin this evening with two announcements. One is that we will conclude our study in the book of Acts tonight. My intention is to get us all the way through the end of chapter 28, but you know how quickly I move, so I may or may not accomplish that. But it's my hope that we will get through the end of chapter 28 one way or the other. We will conclude our study in Acts this evening. The second thing I want to tell you is that this evening will be my final session as your teacher in these Wednesday evening Bible studies. Over the past several weeks, it has become obvious to me that it's time for my association with these studies to come to an end. I want to thank you for your faithfulness in attending. I want to thank you for your kindness to me during these studies. I have certainly enjoyed presenting them to you. I hope that they have been beneficial to you and that the Lord has and will use them in your life. So I thank you for that. I want to thank Jeff and Bob especially for their kindness during these past couple of years. As far as the study in Revelation and Daniel is concerned, my present plan is to have a study of Revelation and Daniel in my home. If you decide that you would like to attend a Bible study of Revelation and Daniel in my home, then I would like for you to call me at my home and tell me that you have an interest in coming. It'll be a period of a few weeks before we start. For the next week or so, a couple of weeks, I'm not going to be doing much talking. And I won't be doing any eating. They're going to do some major excavations in my mouth tomorrow morning. So the doctor tells me that I'm going to be feeling pretty punk for the next couple of weeks. So I will not be available to talk to you, but if you would like to call my home, tell me that you have an interest in coming, then please leave your name and your telephone number for me. And I will get back with you with details of that study. It will not be on a Wednesday night. I don't want to do anything that's going to conflict with anything held in this church or in any other church in the way of a midweek service. More than likely, it'll be on a Tuesday evening. So, if you have an interest, you're welcome to let me know. And we will take a look at that. Okay? All right. You're going to have to listen very quickly tonight because we've got, what am I doing? I'm banging against something here. In our previous study, we saw Paul attacked by a Jewish mob as he went to the temple for the purpose of setting up a purification rite for himself and for four members of the church at Jerusalem. While he was there, getting ready for that purification rite, he was attacked by a Jewish mob who dragged him out of the temple and began beating him with the intention of killing him. But the Lord intervened and had the Roman garrison, which is part of the temple area, soldiers from there came and rescued him from the Jewish mob. He was then taken by the then governor or proconsul Felix to his palace in Caesarea. After he made a defense of himself before the Jewish mob, he was taken to Caesarea, and we saw him in our last session giving his defense before the proconsul or governor Felix. at the end of chapter 24, which is where we ended last time, we saw that Felix had been replaced or was replaced by a new proconsul or governor, a man named Porcius Festus. As we resume our study tonight with the start of chapter 25, we'll see Festus, this new governor or proconsul, trying to get some sort of handle on this mess that he had inherited from Felix, his predecessor. So we'll begin reading, and we'll read the entire chapter 25. It's relatively long, 27 verses. But Acts chapter 25, Festus, therefore, having arrived in the province 3 days later, went up to Jerusalem from Caesarea. And the chief priests and the leading men of the Jews brought charges against Paul, and they were urging him, requesting a concession against Paul, that he might have him brought to Jerusalem, at the same time setting an ambush to kill him on the way. Festus then answered that Paul was being kept in custody at Caesarea and that he himself was about to leave shortly. Therefore, he said, let the influential men among you go there with me, and if there's anything wrong about the man, let them prosecute him. And after he had spent not more than 8 or 10 days among them, he went down to Caesarea, and on the next day he took his seat on the tribunal and ordered Paul to be brought. And after he arrived, the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood around him, bringing many and serious charges against him, which they could not prove. While Paul said in his own defense, I have committed no offense either against the law of the Jews or against the temple or against Caesar. But Festus, wishing to do the Jews a favor, answered Paul and said, are you willing to go up to Jerusalem and stand trial before me on these charges? But Paul said, I'm standing before Caesar's tribunal where I ought to be tried. I've done no wrong to the Jews, as you also know very well. If then I am a wrongdoer and have committed anything worthy of death, I do not refuse to die. But if none of those things is true of which these men accuse me, no one can hand me over to them. Then he makes a momentous statement. He says, I appeal to Caesar. Then when Festus had conferred with his council, he answered, you've appealed to Caesar. To Caesar you shall go. Now, when several days had elapsed, King Agrippa and Bernice arrived at Caesarea and paid their respects to Festus. And while they were spending many days there, Festus laid Paul's case before the king, saying, there's a certain man left a prisoner by Felix. And when I was at Jerusalem, the chief priests and the elders of the Jews brought charges against him, asking for a sentence of condemnation upon him, death, in other words. And I answered them that it is not the custom of the Romans to hand over any man before the accused meets his accusers face to face and has an opportunity to make his defense against the charges. And so after they had assembled here, I made no delay, but on the next day took my seat on the tribunal and ordered the man to be brought. And when the accusers stood up, they began bringing charges against him, not of such crimes as I was expecting, but they simply had some points of disagreement with him about their own religion and about a certain dead man, Jesus, whom Paul asserted to be alive. And being at a loss how to investigate such matters, I asked whether he was willing to go to Jerusalem and there stand trial on these matters. But when Paul appealed to be held in custody for the emperor's decision, I ordered him to be kept in custody until I send him to Caesar. And Agrippa said to Festus, I also would like to hear the man myself. Tomorrow, he said, you shall hear him. And so on the next day, when Agrippa had come together with Bernice amid great pomp and had entered the auditorium accompanied by the commanders and the prominent men of the city, at the command of Festus, Paul was brought in. And Festus said, King Agrippa, and all you gentlemen here present with us, you behold this man about whom all the people of the Jews appeal to me, both at Jerusalem and here, loudly declaring that he ought not to live any longer. But I found that he had committed nothing worthy of death, and since he himself appealed to the emperor, I decided to send him. Yet I have nothing definite about him to write to my Lord. Therefore, I have brought him before you all, and especially before you, King Agrippa, so that after the investigation has taken place, I may have something to write. For it seems absurd to me in sending a prisoner not to indicate also the charges against him. This Festus apparently was not a man who believed in sitting around for a long time, because he hadn't been in Caesarea more than 3 days. He just arrived and just got settled in the palace, and he immediately left Caesarea and went up to Jerusalem to see if he could figure out what was going on with this prisoner that he had. I'm sure that he'd had some information given to him by Felix, and certainly by the Roman commander of the garrison in Jerusalem, about what had gone on. But he wanted to find out for himself what was happening. In verses 2 and 3, when he got there, we're told the chief priests and the leading men of the Jews immediately began leveling charges at Paul and trying to get the new proconsul or governor to agree to bring Paul to Jerusalem again. Luke tells us in verse 3 that their reason for wanting Paul brought to Jerusalem was so they could ambush him along the way. They had already tried to ambush him before, obviously. We saw that. That plot had been foiled. They had tried to get him condemned before Felix and had failed there because they really didn't have a case. So what they're doing here with the new governor, the new guy on the block, is to see if they can't get him to bring him up to Jerusalem so they can ambush him and kill him on the way. They have no idea that they're ever going to be able to convict Paul. But they do have an idea that they might be able to kill him if they can just get Festus to bring him up to Jerusalem. Verse 4, Festus, perhaps sensing that there was something fishy about their request, refused them. Rather, he said that Paul was going to continue to remain in Caesarea. Verse 5, Festus also said that if they had charges to bring against Paul, they would need to come to Caesarea for a trial before the Roman tribunal over which he would preside. So, in verse 6, 8 or 10 days later, he returned to Caesarea and set up the tribunal and took his place on the bema, which is the seat of judgment, and ordered Paul to be brought in. The Roman court was called a tribunal because the Roman judge in the Roman court system was called a tribune. So thus the name tribunal for the court that he sat in. Verse 7, Luke then tells us that the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem leveled many and serious charges against Paul, but they were charges, we're told, that they could not prove. They tried before to prove charges against him, and they were unable to do that as well. From verse 8, from Paul's response, it seems that he was being accused of three things: violating the Jewish law, which they had accused him of before; desecrating the Jewish temple. Remember, they said that he brought a Gentile into the inner courts of the temple, thus desecrating the temple. He had not, and they couldn't prove that he had. And of instigating rebellion, which would have been an action seen as in opposition to the rule of Caesar. Verse 9, Festus could see that the Jews had no case against Paul, but he was reluctant to just let him go. So as a way of placating the Jews, Festus asked Paul if he would be willing to go to Jerusalem and stand trial before Festus there. The problem Festus had was twofold. One is, obviously, the charges against Paul by these Jewish leaders were not violations of Roman law so much as they were violations of Jewish law. And Festus didn't know anything about Jewish law. That's the reason why he said, would you be willing to go up to Jerusalem and stand trial before me up there? Paul said, as we're going to see in just a minute, no, not going to do that. But Festus also had the problem that he didn't want to just turn Paul loose, even though he couldn't find any charges against him that could be proved, because he was afraid of irritating or making angry the Jews. So he was in something of a pickle. Verses 10 and 11, Paul's response to Festus' question was, no, I'm standing before a Roman tribunal, which is where I should be tried. Remember, he's a Roman citizen. He should be tried before a Roman tribunal. And that's what he's saying. He then pointed out to Festus that it was easy to see that he had committed no crime. He then went on to say that if he was guilty of any crime deserving death, he was fully prepared to die. But none of the charges brought by the Jews were true, then he was not going to be turned over to them by anyone, including Festus. That's the point at which he said, I appeal to Caesar. Now, as a Roman citizen, one of the rights that he had was if he thought that he was not getting a fair hearing or fair trial or wasn't being treated fairly, a Roman citizen had the right to appeal to Caesar, to have his case heard by the emperor. And so Paul makes that statement, I appeal to Caesar. Verse 12, after conferring with some of his advisors, to be sure that he was doing the right thing, apparently, Festus said, you've appealed to Caesar. To Caesar you shall go. In verse 13, we're told that after several days, King Agrippa and Bernice arrived. This Agrippa, I told you the last time we were together that we're going to get to a point where you couldn't tell the players without a scorecard. This Agrippa is King Agrippa II. He is the great grandson of Herod the Great. Remember that Herod the Great was the king when Jesus was born. He's also the king who built, or greatly enlarged the temple in Jerusalem and really, dressed it up. It wasn't quite the glory of Solomon's temple that had been destroyed by the Babylonians, but Herod the Great had restored, a great deal of glory to the temple in Jerusalem. He's also the one who built this palace in Caesarea where the Roman proconsul stayed. Herod the Great is also the one, you remember, who had all the babies in Bethlehem, all the male children in Bethlehem killed, trying to kill this new king of the Jews that the wise men came to worship. So that was Herod the Great. After Herod the Great, we had Herod Antipas. Herod Antipas was the Herod when Jesus was tried. He's the one who had John the Baptizer beheaded. After Herod Antipas died, then Herod Agrippa I came to power. He's the one who had James the Apostle beheaded. That was this Herod's father. He's also the one who, remember, came out with great pomp and circumstance with his royal robes on and had the Jews worship him and say, the voice of a God and not of a man. And we're told because of that, that God's angel struck him and he was eaten by worms and died. Pretty nasty way to go. That's this guy's father. So this is Herod Agrippa II, great grandson of Herod the Great. Bernice is his sister and his wife. They were living in an incestuous relationship. Quite a family, if you look at their family tree. Since Festus was the new Roman governor, it would be natural for them to come to Caesarea in order to get acquainted and pay their respects. Then in verses 14 through 21, Festus recounted for Agrippa the events that had occurred with regard to Paul since Festus had arrived. Notice in verse 19, if you will, that Festus identifies what he considers to be the crux of the whole deal, which is this certain dead man by the name of Jesus, whom Paul says is still alive. Festus was very much aware that Jesus had been crucified by the Romans. And he was also very much aware that when Romans crucify somebody, he's not still alive. He's dead. And the Romans had no inkling of resurrection. And so we're going to see a little bit later that as Paul talks about the resurrection of Jesus in front of Festus, Festus says, Paul, you're crazy. You're nutty. Because he couldn't get his mind around that. Verse 22, Agrippa apparently found this story interesting because he said he would like to hear Paul for himself. So Festus said that he would arrange it. Verses 23 through 27 then are Festus' introduction of Paul to Agrippa and Bernice. In verse 25, notice that Festus admitted that he had not found Paul to be guilty of anything. The Jews had charged him with many things, but he had not found him guilty of anything. In fact, he confessed to being a little perplexed because he said he was sending a man to Caesar for a hearing without even knowing how to describe the charges against him. So Festus told Agrippa that he was hoping that if Agrippa could examine Paul or talk to him, that somehow he would be able to clarify what these charges were. His reason for wanting Agrippa to talk to Paul was that Agrippa was familiar with Jewish religious law and Jewish customs. Festus was not. So he wanted Agrippa to talk to him. Understand now that Paul had had a hearing before two Roman proconsuls, first Felix and now Festus, and neither one has found him guilty of anything. Chapter 26, then, is Paul's presentation before King Agrippa II and his sister and wife, Bernice. Notice or take note of the fact that Paul was not obligated to say a single word to Agrippa. He had appealed to Caesar. And really from this point on, as a legal matter, the only person that Paul needed to talk to was the emperor. But he took this opportunity to talk to Agrippa and Bernice and again to Festus, and really to give them his Christian testimony. He saw it as an opportunity to witness to them. That's why he took the trouble in verse 26 to speak to the entire group. So verse 26, at the end of verse 25, we have seen Festus telling Agrippa about Paul. Paul's been brought in and he's standing there while Festus lays out what had been happening. So in verse 1 of chapter 26, Agrippa turned to Paul and said, "You're permitted to speak for yourself." In other words, what he's saying is, Festus has been telling me all about it. Now I want to hear from you. You tell me. What's the story? Give me your version of events. Then Paul, it says, stretched out his hand and proceeded to make his defense. He said, "In regard to all the things of which I am accused by the Jews, I consider myself fortunate, King Agrippa, that I'm about to make my defense before you today, especially because you are an expert in all customs and questions among the Jews. Therefore, I beg you to listen to me patiently." I don't know whether Paul was trying to butter Agrippa up at all. There was no reason for him to, because Agrippa had no power over him once he'd appealed to Caesar. But I think he is stating a fact that Agrippa did know Jewish law. He had familiarized himself with Jewish law and customs. Therefore, Paul said, I'm glad to have somebody in front of me who knows that I'm not guilty of anything. So let me tell you what has happened. Verse 4, so then, all Jews know my manner of life from my youth up, which from the beginning was spent among my own nation and at Jerusalem, since they have known about me for a long time previously, if they are willing to testify, that I lived as a Pharisee according to the strictest sect of our religion. Paul says, I was born and raised in Tarsus in Cilicia, grew up there as a Jew. Then I came to Jerusalem, and not only did I become a Pharisee, I went to school at the rabbinic school of Gamaliel. So I've had the finest training in Jewish law and the Jewish religion. And he said, these people who are making all these accusations against me, they know all of this. It's not a secret. Paul was a prominent Jew in Jerusalem in those days. Verse 6, he says, and now I am standing trial for the hope of the promise made by God to our fathers, the promise to which our 12 tribes hope to attain as they earnestly serve God night and day. And for this hope, O king, I am being accused by the Jews. What he's referring to there is the resurrection. He says, the reason I am standing before you today is because I've been preaching the resurrection. He said, I don't know why that's so strange, because the resurrection is all over the scripture. Jews have been taught about the resurrection, that there's going to be a resurrection of the dead at the end of the age. All Jews know that. And he's saying, basically, to Agrippa, you know that. Verse 8, he says, why is it considered incredible among you people if God does raise the dead? I've been talking about the resurrection of Jesus Christ, and people are attacking me for that. Why do you consider the resurrection of Jesus to be something God is incapable of doing? You believe in the resurrection. So then, I thought to myself that I had to do many things hostile to the name of Jesus of Nazareth. He's going back now to his Jewish roots. And this is just what I did in Jerusalem. Not only did I lock up many of the saints in prisons, having received authority from chief priests, but also when they were being put to death, I cast my vote against them. And we've seen that Paul was certainly the leading persecutor of the Christians in Jerusalem in those early days. Verse 11, and as I punished them often in all the synagogues, I tried to force them to blaspheme, and being furiously enraged at them, I kept pursuing them even to foreign cities. While thus engaged, I was journeying to Damascus with the authority and commission of the chief priests. At midday, O king, I saw on the way a light from heaven, brighter than the sun, shining all around me and those who were journeying with me. And when we had all fallen to the ground, I heard a voice saying to me in the Hebrew dialect, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? It is hard for you to kick against the goads. And we looked at that phrase earlier, when we looked at Saul's conversion. In verse 15, Paul said, I said, who are you, Lord? And the Lord said, I am Jesus whom you are persecuting. But arise and stand on your feet, for this purpose I have appeared to you, to appoint you a minister and a witness, not only to the things which you have seen, but also to the things which I will appear to you, in which I will appear to you. What Jesus is making reference to there is that he's going to be spending some time with Paul later on in the Arabian desert, instructing him in the things that he wants him to teach people. Verse 17, delivering you from the Jewish people and from the Gentiles, to whom I am sending you, to open their eyes so that they may turn from darkness to light and from the dominion of Satan to God, in order that they may receive forgiveness of sins and an inheritance among those who have been sanctified by faith in me. So Paul is simply telling Agrippa here about the commission that Jesus had given to him on the road to Damascus. He was going to send him to the Jews, yes, but primarily as the apostle to the Gentiles. Verse 19, consequently, King Agrippa, I did not prove disobedient to the heavenly vision, but kept declaring both to those of Damascus first, and also at Jerusalem, and then throughout all the region of Judea, and even to the Gentiles, that they should repent and turn to God, performing deeds appropriate to repentance. And again, we've looked at all of that in detail as we saw the early ministry of Paul, which after he had gotten to Damascus, after his experience on the road, and he'd received his eyesight back, he began preaching immediately to the people in Damascus and various other areas. Verse 21, for this reason some Jews seized me in the temple and tried to put me to death. What he's saying is that his preaching of Jesus Christ to the Gentiles is the reason why they initially tried to put him to death. And so having obtained help from God, I stand to this day testifying to both to small and great, stating nothing but what the prophets and Moses said was going to take place, that the Christ was to suffer, and that by reason of his resurrection from the dead, he should be the first to proclaim light both to the Jewish people and to the Gentiles. Verse 24, and while Paul was saying this in his defense, Festus said in a loud voice, Paul, you are out of your mind. Your great learning is driving you mad. Paul, he said, you're a man of great education, great wisdom. Obviously, you're very intelligent, but you're out of your gourd. You're talking about resurrection. Resurrection, Paul, is not something that happens. Paul makes a kind of a side reference to this later in his letter to the Corinthians when he says to them in chapter 1 of the Corinthians that the cross of Christ is to the Jews a stumbling block, something that they trip over. To the Greeks, that is the Gentiles, including Festus, it's foolishness, stupidity. You got to be crazy to believe that. And that's what Festus is saying to him here. But Paul said, verse 25, I'm not out of my mind, most excellent Festus, but I utter words of sober truth. For the king knows about these matters, and I speak to him also with confidence, since I am persuaded that none of these things escape his notice, for this has not been done in a corner. What he's referencing is that he says, I'm talking to Agrippa here about the resurrection, and Agrippa knows the story of Jesus. He knows what went on. This wasn't done in the dark. So he's aware of all these things that have happened. Then he turns to Agrippa in verse 27 and he says, King Agrippa, do you believe the prophets? I know that you do. And Agrippa, feeling the pressure of Paul's confronting him, and I'm confident, feeling the pressure of the Holy Spirit who's boring in on him, says in response to Paul, in a short time you will persuade me to become a Christian. That a much more accurate translation of that would be in the form of a question, folks. What Agrippa is saying here is, Paul, do you think in this brief time that you're actually going to convince me to become a Christian? Not going to happen, buddy. And Paul said, verse 29, I would to God that whether in a short or long time, not only you, but also all who hear me this day, including Bernice and Festus, might become such as I am, except for these chains. In other words, I wish that you all would become followers of Christ. I wish that you were exactly like me, he said, minus these chains that I've got on here. I wouldn't wish that on you. Verse 30, and the king arose, and the governor and Bernice, and those who were sitting with them. And when they had drawn aside, they began talking to one another, saying, This man is not doing anything worthy of death or imprisonment. In other words, he shouldn't even be in custody. Not only should he not be killed, he's done nothing that he should be imprisoned for. And Agrippa said to Festus, this man might have been set free if he had not appealed to Caesar. But since he's appealed to Caesar, remember, to Caesar you shall go. Now we come to verse chapter 27, which is the account of Paul's voyage from Caesarea to Rome with a rather interesting side trip on the way. As we read this chapter, by the way, and look at it in some detail, I would just remind you that as we look at this voyage, which is fraught with peril, ends in the entire ship being broken up. 276 people on this ship were rescued. Not one of them died because God had told Paul that all the lives would be saved, but the ship was going to be wrecked. And I would remind you that Paul had been visited back in chapter 23, if you remember, by Jesus Christ himself. And Jesus had said to Paul, you are going to go and be my witness in Rome. So what I would remind you of as we read this chapter is, Paul is dead center in the middle of God's will. Is he not? Well, if he's in the center of God's will, then this voyage across the Mediterranean from Caesarea to Rome should be one of gentle breezes and bright sunshine and an easy trip. Should it not? I mean, if he's in God's will, that's the way it ought to be. Not exactly. There are preachers and teachers who will tell you that God always wants to have you be happy and wealthy and healthy. Ask them, when they teach you that, if chapter 27 of the book of Acts appears in their Bible. Paul was in God's will. Paul had faith. He raised somebody from the dead. This is not a happy trip. And by the way, he's going to end up on an island. Well, we'll get to that. Chapter 27. And when it was decided that that's Luke and Paul, and a man named Aristarchus from Thessalonica, we should sail for Italy, they proceeded to deliver Paul and some other prisoners to a centurion of the Augustan cohort named Julius. And embarking in an Adramidian ship, Adramidium is a port on the west coast of Asia Minor, just south of Troas. So this was a ship from that port in Asia Minor, which was about to sail to the regions along the coast of Asia, we put out to sea accompanied by Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica. And the next day we put in at Sidon, and Julius, that's the Roman centurion, treated Paul with consideration and allowed him to go to his friends and receive care. Now what we're going to see on this trip is that the habit of people who sailed on the ocean, on the Mediterranean Sea in those days, was they didn't just leave Caesarea and sail directly across the middle of the Mediterranean to Italy. Rather, they sailed close to the land. They went north up to Sidon, and now we're going to see them go west along the coast to try to stay out of bad weather in the ship. And we'll see them put in a little bit later at a port and get on another ship that's supposed to be going to Italy. Verse 4, and from there we put out to sea and sailed under the shelter of Cyprus because the winds were contrary. And when we had sailed along the sea, sailed through the sea along the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we landed at Myra in Lycia. And there the centurion found an Alexandrian ship, that would be a ship from Alexandria in Egypt, sailing for Italy. And he put us aboard it. And when we had sailed slowly for a good many days and with difficulty had arrived off Cnidus, since the wind would not permit us to go farther, we sailed under the shelter of Crete off Salmon. If you still had your map, as I do, you would see that they were sailing along here. They sailed westward along the coast of Cilicia and Lycia. They put in at Myra. Then they sailed along the south part of the island of Crete, it says, off Salmon. And with difficulty sailing past it, we came to a certain place called Fair Havens, near which was the city of Lycia. And that's on the western or the southern part of the island of Crete. And when considerable time had passed and the voyage was now dangerous, since even the fast was over, Paul began to admonish them and said to them, "Men, I perceive that the voyage will certainly be attended with damage and great loss, not only of the cargo of the ship, but also of our lives." But the centurion was more persuaded by the pilot and the captain of the ship than by what was being said by Paul. Paul advised them not to make the trip because he said the weather's going to be bad, it's going to be a rough trip. But this centurion was listening to the captain of the ship rather than listening to this Pharisee Jew from Jerusalem. Verse 12, and because the harbor was not suitable for wintering, the majority reached a decision to put out to sea from there if somehow they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete facing southwest and northwest, and spend the winter there. Phoenix was on the western, southwestern side of the island of Crete, and that's where they were going to spend the winter. Verse 13, when a moderate south wind came up, supposing that they had gained their purpose, they weighed anchor and began sailing along Crete close inshore. But before very long, there rushed down from the land a violent wind called Euroquilo. Euroquilo is a kind of a hybrid word that's part Greek and part Latin, and it literally means northeast or east north. It was a violent wind that came down off the island and hit the ship. In New England today, if they have a really bad storm in the wintertime, they call it a nor'easter. And that's essentially what they've got here, a northeast wind, which was exactly what they didn't need in order to get to where they wanted to go. And when the ship was caught in it and could not face the wind, we gave way to it and let ourselves be driven along. And running under the shelter of a small island called Clauda, we were scarcely able to get the ship's boat under control. They were apparently towing a small skiff, or what we would refer to as a rowboat, behind this ship, and they couldn't get it under control. Verse 17, after they had hoisted it up, they used supporting cables in undergirding the ship, and fearing that they might run aground in the shallows of Syrtis, they let down the sea anchor and so let themselves be driven along. They're being driven along by this violent wind. In order to slow themselves down some, they dropped their sea anchor over the side and let it drag so as to keep them from being blown too far out to sea. Verse 18, the next day as we were being violently storm-tossed, they began to jettison the cargo. And on the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. These men are getting desperate. This is some kind of storm that they're in. And since neither sun nor stars appeared for, notice, many days, and no small storm was assailing us, from then on, all hope of our being saved was gradually abandoned. They were losing hope that they were going to live. And when they had gone a long time without food, then Paul stood up in their midst and said, "Men, you ought to have followed my advice and not to have set sail from Crete and incurred this damage and loss." Paul says, "I told you so." Verse 22, "And yet now I urge you to keep up your courage, for there shall be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For this very night, an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I serve stood before me, saying, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar, and behold, God has granted you all those who are sailing with you.'" So this angel came to Paul and said, not only are you going to survive this, Paul, although it may not look like it right now, but there's not going to be the loss of life of anyone who is on this ship. "Therefore, keep up your courage, men, for I believe God that it will turn out exactly as I have been told. But we must run aground on a certain island," which they will. "But when the 14th night had come, as we were being driven about in the Adriatic Sea, about midnight, the sailors began to surmise that they were approaching some land. And they took soundings and found it to be 20 fathoms. And a little further on, they took another sounding and found it to be 15 fathoms. This is a heavy weight attached to a line that they drop over the side of the boat to see how deep the water is. That's what a sounding means. They're checking to see how much water is under the boat. As you can see, the amount of water is getting smaller. "And fearing that we might run aground somewhere on the rocks, they cast 4 anchors from the stern and wished for daybreak." I bet they did. "And as the sailors were trying to escape from the ship and had let down the ship's boat into the sea on the pretense of intending to lay out anchors from the bow, Paul said to the centurion and to the soldiers, 'Unless these men remain in the ship, you yourselves cannot be saved.' The angel had promised Paul that everyone who stayed on the boat would live." Paul's saying if they get off the ship and go in this little boat, then they're not going to be saved. Verse 32, "Then the soldiers cut away the ropes of the ship's boat and let it fall away to keep them from getting into it. And until the day was about to dawn, Paul was encouraging them all to take some food, saying, 'Today is the 14th day that you've been constantly watching and going without eating, having taken nothing. Therefore, I encourage you to take some food, for this is for your preservation. For not a hair of the head of any of you shall perish.' And having said this, he took bread and gave thanks to God in the presence of all, and he broke it and began to eat. And all of them were encouraged, and they themselves also took food. And all of us in the ship were 276 persons. And when they'd eaten enough, they began to lighten the ship by throwing out the wheat into the sea. And when day came, they could not recognize the land, but they did observe a certain bay with a beach, and they resolved to drive the ship onto it if they could. And casting off the anchors, they left them in the sea, while at the same time they were loosening the ropes of the rudders and hoisting the foresail to the wind. They were heading for the beach. But striking a reef where the two seas met, they ran the vessel aground, and the prow stuck fast and remained immovable, but the stern began to be broken up by the force of the waves. So they hit this reef, the front of the ship wedged in the reef, and the waves were breaking against the back of it, so it was tearing the ship apart, basically. And the soldiers, that is the Roman soldiers' plan, was to kill the prisoners so that none of them should swim away and escape. Remember the Roman law. If your prisoners escape, you die. So these Roman soldiers decided that rather than them die, they were going to kill the prisoners and keep them from getting away. Verse 43, but the centurion, wanting to bring Paul safely through, kept them from their intention and commanded that those who could swim should jump overboard first and get to land, and the rest should follow, some on planks and others on various things from the ship. And thus it happened that they all were brought safely to land. So they've been driven across the sea by this violent wind, and they have come to this place. They don't know yet where they are, but their ship has been broken up, but everyone on the ship is now safely on the beach. Chapter 28. And when they had been brought safely through, then they found out that the island was called Malta. And if you look on your map, Malta is way, way, way south, a couple hundred miles south of Italy. It's way down below where they wanted to be. And the natives showed us extraordinary kindness, for because of the rain that had set in and because of the cold, they kindled a fire and received us all. But when Paul had gathered a bundle of sticks and laid them on the fire, a viper came out because of the heat and fastened on his hand. Oh, good. Paul has just survived a shipwreck, gets on the beach, goes to get some firewood, picks it up, and because of the heat, there's a viper in the wood and it bites him, fastens onto his hand. Yes, God always wants you to have cool breezes and no problems. And when the natives saw the creature hanging from his hand, they began saying to one another, undoubtedly this man is a murderer, and though he has been saved from the sea, justice has not allowed him to live. Their assumption was because this snake had bitten him, he was going to die. And that must be a sign, according to them, that he is a murderer. Because God, personified here as justice, is going to kill him. But they were expecting, however, he shook the creature off into the fire and suffered no harm. I don't know about you, I'm impressed by Paul's calmness. The snake bites him. Now, if a snake had bitten me, the next thing they would have seen would have been me about 200 yards away, screaming and yelling. Paul shakes the snake off into the fire and says, no problem, guys. But they were expecting that he was about to swell up or suddenly fall down dead. They were familiar with what kind of snake this was. And this was a snake, apparently, that people did not survive the bite of. But after they had waited a long time and had seen nothing unusual happen to him, they changed their minds and began to say that he was a god. Now, in the neighborhood of that place were lands belonging to the leading man of the island named Publius, who welcomed us and entertained us courteously 3 days. 276 people. Publius welcomed them in and entertained them, it says, courteously for 3 days. That's going to take a lot of bacon and eggs, folks. And it came about that the father of Publius was lying in bed, afflicted with recurrent fever and dysentery. And Paul went in to see him, and after he had prayed, he laid his hands on him and healed him. After this had happened, the rest of the people on the island who had diseases were coming to him and getting cured. They also honored us with many marks of respect, and while we were setting sail, they supplied us with all that we needed. Early church history indicates that during this period of time when Paul was on Malta, he established that church there, and that Publius, the man whose father was healed here, became its first pastor. Isn't that interesting? And at the end of 3 months, we set sail on an Alexandrian ship which had wintered at the island and which had the twin brothers for its figurehead. And after we had put in at Syracuse, or as they say in Sicily, Syracusa, we stayed there for 3 days. And from there we sailed around and arrived at Regium, And a day later, a south wind sprang up, and on the second day, we came to Puteoli. There we found some brethren, and were invited to stay with them for 7 days, and thus we came to Rome. And the brethren, when they had heard about us, came from there as far as the market of Appius and three inns to meet us. And when Paul saw them, he thanked God and took courage. And when we entered Rome, Paul was allowed to stay by himself with the soldier who was guarding him. What happened in Rome was that Paul was under house arrest in Rome, in his own quarters, chained to a Roman guard for 2 years. None of his Jewish accusers from Jerusalem ever showed up to charge him with anything. So he never had a hearing before Caesar, because they'd already failed twice with Felix and Festus, and I guess they just didn't see the advantage of making this long trip to Rome for a hearing before the emperor that they were not going to be able to prove anyway. So they never showed up. Paul was there in under house arrest in Rome for 2 years. While he was there, he wrote what we commonly refer to as the prison epistles. After 2 years of house arrest, he was released by the Roman Emperor Nero. After his release, he visited Ephesus. He left Timothy there to supervise the churches in Asia Minor. Then he went to Macedonia, from where he wrote the book 1 Timothy. Then he went to Crete and left Titus there to supervise the churches on Crete. He then went to Nicopolis in southern Greece. Finally, he visited Troas, where he was suddenly arrested and brought back to Rome. What had happened back in Rome, if you remember your history, was that Rome was burned. Most people, most historians, believe that the fire was actually set by Nero. He was crazy as a bedbug. And there's the old saying about Nero fiddling while Rome burned. Well, we don't know whether he fiddled or not, but he probably did set fire to Rome. But he had to have somebody to blame for the fire, so he blamed the Christians. And that's when the real persecution of the Christians under Nero began. He rearrested Paul in Troas, had him brought back to Rome, and this time, instead of being under house arrest, he put him in what is called the Mamertine prison. And he was actually in a hole in the floor. They dug out a hole in the ground, and Paul was lowered down through this hole and was kept there for a period of several months. It was extremely cold there. He was in his own waste for that period of time, and it was a horrible existence. He actually wrote 2 Timothy while he was in that hole in the Mamertine prison. And then shortly thereafter, Nero martyred Paul, we believe, according to early church history, by having him beheaded. The legend is that Paul ran to the chopping block to have his head chopped off so that he could see his Lord and Savior quicker. Peter was also martyred during this same time by Nero. That's all the time we have for this evening. Thank you very much for your kind attention tonight and over the past couple of years. May God richly bless you.